From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, astrological predictions for this year and beyond. Here's what's happening. Former New York Jets cornerback Philip Adams killed a doctor, his wife, their two children, grandchildren, then himself in South Carolina, according to police. York County Sheriff's officers responded to a Rock Hill home just before 5 p.m. after reports of a shooting found the five victims. A very sad, tragic story. And the father of Philip Adams, a former NFL player who was identified as that gunman in that South Carolina shooting that left five dead, said football might bear some of the blame. Adams played the NFL from 2010 to 2015 and suffered multiple injuries, including concussions and a broken ankle, according to his father. Sad story. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden and his Attorney General Merrick Garland announced limited measures to tackle gun violence in the United States in what the White House has described as a first step to curb mass shootings, community bloodshed, and suicides. The new measures include plans for the Justice Department to crack down on self-assembled ghost guns, as they call them, and make them stabilizing braces, which effectively turn pistols into rifles, subject to registration under the National Firearms Act. President Biden said he will ask the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to release an annual report on firearms trafficking in the United States and make it easier for states to adopt red flag laws that flag at-risk individuals who own guns. The president also outlined more ambitious goals that he needs the support of Congress to accomplish, including reinforcing a ban on assault weapons and passing a nationwide red flag law. John Lott, president of the newly formed Crime Prevention Research Center and author of a number of books, including Freedomomics, is with us right now. John, your thoughts on what the president's been doing?
Well, it's good to talk to you. I was kind of stunned by how many really dishonest statements that the president made today. You know, everything from saying that gun makers and gun sellers were completely exempt from lawsuits to claims about the Charleston, so-called Charleston loophole, to claims about the background check system, and even gun shows and other things. So, you know, take the claim about lawsuits against companies, gun makers. If they produce a defective gun, you can sue them. If they break the law, for example, and sell a gun without a background check, you can sue them if there's any damage that results from that. What Biden's proposing is actually very different. He wants to make gun makers civilly liable for any misuse of the guns that they sell. So if you sell a gun and it's used in a crime, then you should be able to go and sue the gun maker and the people who sold it. I mean, could you imagine applying that standard to car companies? I mean, there's 4.5 million people each year that are injured in car accidents that require medical care. If somebody's texting or if they're talking and distracted and they get into an accident, should Ford Motor be responsible for that accident? And you know, it's basically, you know, you have something like that, it's just a sure way of putting companies out of business. You know, you look at, he went into a long discussion about the Charleston loophole, and basically it was a lie. He was saying that if it was because they only had 3 days to do the check on Dylan Roof's background, and if they had had longer, they would have found that he was prevented from being able to buy a gun, prohibited, and that it would have stopped him from getting the gun that he used to engage in that horrible Charleston church shooting, the black church in 2015. You're prohibited from buying a gun if you're a felon or if you have a conviction for some types of misdemeanors or if you've been arrested but not yet convicted, if the crime could result in a prison term of at least 1 year. But the thing is, he had none of those things. He had been arrested for a misdemeanor drug offense, which the maximum possible sentence was 6 months. So are Democrats going to go and say that we should change the law so any arrest but not a conviction for a misdemeanor should mean that you're not allowed to buy guns? Or are they, what they, I think they really want to do is impose a 30-day waiting period because that's what their bill would allow them. to go and delay the sale of guns. Well, if they want a 30-day waiting period, say they want a 30-day waiting period and defend it. But don't go and try to rape it, to drape it in this horrible crime and claim that the type of bill that they're putting forward would have prevented it, because it has nothing to do with what happened in that case.
Exactly. John, keep in touch with us. Good to have you back, by the way. 13 people at a COVID-19 vaccination site in Colorado had adverse reactions to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine on Wednesday, and they shut down the operations for at least the day. The vaccination effort was being sponsored by the state and a health department. More than 600 people with appointments were unable to receive their vaccinations after the early closure. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has announced that the state of Florida is suing the federal government over a failure to lift restrictions on cruise ships as the U.S. stages its recovery from the coronavirus pandemic there. Well, if your friend is in a state of sheer delight or intense fright, the ear-ringing sounds that some people make apparently make it hard to tell, right? A new study finds that most people can't tell the difference between screams of joy and screams of terror. Researchers from Emory University say screams of happiness are also interpreted as screams of fear because they both have similar acoustic features. Resident psychiatrist Dr. Peter Breggin with us. Peter, they'll do a study on just about anything, won't they?
They will, George, and they do a lousy job, too. But I had a kind of fun thoughts about all of this. Have you ever heard two raccoons mating in a tree in the middle of the night, George?
No, I don't spend up my night hours to listen to that, Peter.
Well,
you should be listening to the show instead of raccoons in a tree.
Well, they're screaming, they're yelling, and it's terrifying to hear them. You think they're tearing somebody apart, and then it turns out they're making whoopee. So I think that it's something really basic about these extremes of emotion, of excitement and happiness, fear or terror. The bias, though, is always toward fear, and that's what happened in that study. So if you hear loud, screeching noises, you're going to, evolutionary-wise, you're going to do better off if you interpret it as fear most of the time. If it's a joyful party and you miss it, that's okay. But if it's fear and you walk into some sort of a slaughter, you're really in trouble. And also, I think we, evolutionary, when we heard a scream, it was going to be maybe from our extended family, and we needed to figure out whether to run there to help. So I think the bias is toward hearing a scream and being scared. But I told Ginger something else came up in this study, and that is that they had trouble even finding males who would scream in joy and excitement, to use as their videos. So I told Ginger, that I was going to end this show tonight, and I was going to say, hey, guys, cut loose. And scream with joy, and I was going to let out a loud cowboy Yahoo shout, and I did, and my wife got scared.
So George, I would too, Peter.
It's scary. It's
all right, my friend. Thank you, Dr. Peter Breggin. After almost 30 years, Ayanna Williams has finally cut her fingernails. Why is that a story? Williams from Houston, Texas, snagged the women's world record for the longest fingernails back 4 years ago when her fingernails were 18 feet long. But before Williams got them cut over the weekend, she broke her previous record with her nails measuring 24 feet, 0.7 inches, according to the Guinness World Records. 24 feet fingernails. Is that crazy or what? Kevin Randall's with us right now with his report on UFOs for the week. Kevin, what do you have beyond 24 feet fingernails?
Well, George, I think she'd be a lousy typist.
I bet.
A few days ago, I stumbled across a number of blog postings about the Travis Walton abduction, suggesting there was now a problem between Walton and Mike Rogers. The suggestion or the interpretation of some of those remarks suggested that Rogers was repudiating the abduction, but had stopped just short of calling it a hoax. Having read about the fallout between Travis Walton and Mike Rogers, it seemed to suggest something new was coming. As I said, it seemed that Rogers was close to repudiating the Walton abduction. I know each of those guys, having met them on several occasions. I reached out to Mike Rogers asking about all of this. It seemed to me that he was suggesting the fallout was a personal matter that seemed to relate to the abduction only tangentially. He wasn't repudiating it by saying he was done with Travis Walton, only that his association with Travis Walton was terminated, and that seemed to clarify the matter for me. But then he sent me an email that reminded me that no one had actually seen Walton being abducted. When the men in the pickup truck spotted the UFO near where they had been working, Rogers, who was driving, stopped. They were all in a state of shock by the brightly glowing UFO that was not all that far from them. Travis, fascinated by the craft, got out of the truck and began walking toward it. As he got near, a bright beam of light shot out, striking him. He was thrown back, landing on the ground some distance away. The others, still in the truck and in an even more agitated state, didn't check on their friend. They screamed at Rogers to get them out of there. Rogers turned around and sped away. I actually mentioned to Roger once that I found that a little bit chicken. But, of course, they did return. This is the reason that in the beginning law enforcement thought they might have murdered Walton. What I learned in my communication with both men was that all this had to do with personal matters. It had nothing to do with the abduction case or the UFO sighting. Rogers wasn't about to claim that the whole thing was a hoax. He was annoyed at Travis, and Travis seemed to be annoyed with him. I told both of them I was going to report on this and that having the questions answered, I was going to bow out of the conversation. This was really none of my business, and it was not the business of those in the UFO community. The suggestion of some sort of repudiation of the abduction and, by extension, the UFO sightings were no longer on the table. On Monday, I learned that they have apparently worked out their differences. For those interested, I have more information on my blog about the sighting, about the events surrounding this fallout between the two men, and even an interview with one of the men in the truck, Steve Pierce. And that should complete the picture and wrap up this episode on the abduction phenomenon. And that's what I have for tonight.
Super. We'll talk to you next week. Kevin Randall, an expert. Up next, Jonathan Emore joins us. We'll talk about his latest work, The Authoritarians, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. How much does government try to involve themselves in our lives? Jonathan Emord is the principal of Emord & Associates, practicing constitutional administrative law in Washington, D.C., before a number of federal agencies. He is the only attorney in history that has defeated the FDA a number of times at federal court, six times on First Amendment grounds. Emord began his legal career as an attorney in the Mass Media Bureau of the Federal Communications Commission back in 1985 during the Reagan administration. His latest work is called The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. Pretty extensive work there, Jonathan.
Thank you, George. It was quite a long haul. But one of the incredible things that I learned in the course of doing this book, George, is that what we call socialism actually has been a part of the federal government since the antebellum South, actually. It was a part of the Confederacy. It was the justification, academic justification for the Confederacy. Then it blossomed again in the administrative state in the 1880s. 1887, the first federal administrative agency came into being in the form of the Interstate Commerce Commission. And it has effectively been operating within the government largely in the shadows as far as public awareness is concerned. But it has had a devastating effect on people's lives, on their freedom, and on enterprise in the United States.
Now, let's talk about your work. And by the way, I was privileged to write a little snippet for you for the back cover.
Thank you so much, George, for that endorsement, and I greatly appreciate that. I think it'll bring the book to a lot of people's attention who otherwise might not be aware of it.
Now, what's going on with government and their control? I mean, we just heard from John Lott about what President Joe Biden's trying to do with guns and things like that. Is that the kind of control you're talking about, Jonathan, or is it even more substantial than that?
It is that and more. There's a basic ideological divide that occurred actually first in the antebellum South with those who tried to defend slavery against the abolitionists in the North. And that is a rejection. That ideological divide arose and continues because it is a rejection of the fundamental Lockean principles that underlie the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Essentially, these people, who I call the authoritarians, they're people who believe in submission to a governing will imposed at the expense of individual rights to life, liberty, and property. And they are paternalists. They're state paternalists. And they believe that they can exercise power without being restrained by the Constitution if it furthers what they term to be a common or public good. And this viewpoint that you don't have to follow the Constitution surprisingly arose in America in the antebellum South first as a justification for slavery, and then was adopted after the Civil War by those who advocated during the Progressive Era the creation of government outside of the constitutional branches, and that government was the administrative state. And so the administrative state actually operates in a wholly unconstitutional way, and it has promulgated laws by people who are unelected. There's no consent of the governed involved. It violates the non-delegation doctrine, which limits power to within those branches. Instead, the agencies have combined legislative, executive, and judicial power, what James Madison referred to as the very definition of tyranny. And it runs roughshod over people without affording them any protections that they would have in an Article III court, in a court of law. There's no presumption against, you're not presumed innocent. You don't have a right to confront your accuser. There's no right to a jury trial. There's no right to even perform discovery against the government to find out what the basis is for their action. So, and there's many more parts of this that are just horrific. So this came about in the antebellum South, and then from the antebellum South forward, we have this body of elitists in the United States, mm-hmm. who I document extensively in the book, who progressively push for more government that's not accountable to the people, more government power that is not limited by the Constitution. And they achieve that through the administrative state. By the time Joe Biden becomes president, this is well laid out in the administrative state. And so that's why he immediately resorts to executive orders to perform legislative functions. That's an those executive orders that do that are unconstitutional.
Nobody challenges them, Jonathan.
No one challenges them. So there are actually some states that are challenging him, some successfully, and others have the challenges underway. But you're right. By and large, he's getting away with this, and people are not making him account. And he's very, very fulsome with this, idea that he can run the government as a dictator. He can perform all of these functions without going to Congress. He goes to Congress with what he thinks he can get, but when he doesn't think he can get it, he just runs it through the administrative state and forgets the Constitution. But that is a pattern that was established all the way back in the regime of Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson rejected the Constitution. People don't realize that Wilson rejected the Declaration of Independence. He said the preamble should be not read, it should be eliminated from the Declaration. The preamble is the portion that is the foundational principles of the United States. But it is a tragedy, and we can reverse it, and we have to take steps to do it, and I explain that, too, in the authoritarian.
Is it getting worse than better?
It is getting much worse. In fact, with this last election, we for the first time saw the leaders of a party announce, and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, that they would openly support a presidential candidate who was an avowed socialist.
Interesting.
And they crossed the Rubicon at that point, because then they signaled clearly that they had basically sold their souls to that authoritarian regime. And so prior to that time, no one had the courage or the foolishness
or gumption to do something like that. Stay with us, Jonathan. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about the authoritarians on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your calls with Jonathan E. Mort as we talk about our rights being whittled away. His latest book is called The Authoritarians. His website is his name, his last name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. But calls next hour, I've got more to talk with him about when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Jonathan E. Mort with us. His latest work, The Authoritarians. Kind of a scary cover here, Jonathan. The Hammer and Sickle.
That's what it's all about. They're taking over this country, and it's happening right now.
Did you see where Putin just signed a measure into law which will allow him to retain office until 2036 now?
Right.
What happened to elected offices, huh?
Well, it's been a puppet regime over there for a long time.
Yep, absolutely. Well, let's get back into the motive here for why they do what they do.
Well, the motive is really one of control. The aim here is essentially to deprive people of their liberty so that they can exercise the choice that those people would otherwise exercise for themselves. And in the process, both cause individuals to become more dependent upon government and also cause the state and particular individuals within the state to have greater control over the conduct of individual lives. But as to how people are employed, with whom they associate, how they what they can say publicly, and we're seeing that happen now with this cancel culture environment. It really is extraordinary the extent of control that socialists want. And this is not new to the world. I mean, these Bolshevik type revolutions have occurred since 1917, and the philosophy goes all the way back to the 1800s with Friedrich Hegel. And in fact, that philosophy of collectivism and socialism, where individual rights are not recognized, only collective rights are recognized, and the state defines what those rights are, and no individual can stand in the way. That viewpoint is really at the heart of Hegel's philosophy. Karl Marx was Hegel's student, and he developed it further into communism, but that Hegelian socialism caught on in the United States in the early 1800s, in the 1830s forward, as a justification for slavery. South Carolina's governors, for example, James Hammond and George McDuffie at that time, did something extraordinary. Here you have all the Southerners who died in the Revolutionary War fighting for the principles of the Declaration, and that legacy was there, and it was a very strong hold on the Southern mind. They made a public campaign to repudiate Jefferson and to repudiate the Declaration of Independence, and they actually said that. They said, "I repudiate," and both of them said this, one quoting the other, "I repudiate as ridiculously absurd that much lauded but nowhere accredited dogma of Mr. Jefferson that all men are created equal." And they furthermore referred to him as a monstrous and dangerous fallacy of Thomas Jefferson. They concluded that men are born neither free nor equal. And Edmund Ruffin, who was a famous fire eater who was falsely claimed to have been fired the first shot, cannon shot, at the federal garrison at Fort Sumter, wrote a book in 1857, which was very popular in the South at the time, The Political Economy of Slavery. And there he said, "Our system of domestic slavery offers in use and to the greatest profit for all parties in the association the realization of all that is sound and valuable in the socialist theories and doctrines. Thus, in the institution of domestic slavery, and in that only, are most completely realized the dreams and sanguine hopes of the socialist school." And George Fitzhugh, another Southern academic of the time, referred to slavery, domestic slavery, as the, quote, "oldest, best, and most common form of socialism," unquote, and plantation slavery as the, quote, "beau ideal of communism." So they were all in. They were all in for the idea of total government control, and rejected the foundational principles of this country. And that's what it's all about. Socialism is nothing more than the achievement of state a state monopoly on enslavement of the population.
Now, is it just executive orders, Jonathan? Because every president has signed executive orders. I mean, Trump signed 220 during his term. Biden's at 38 already. Theodore Roosevelt, 1,081. They seem to all do it.
Well, that's right. And if in the authoritarians, I document the history of the use of authoritarian power all the way back to its origins and each of the presidents and their roles and each of key people that are largely not known, not understood by the American people to have been instrumental, and all of the administrative actions. But the reason why these executive orders are different, and they weren't, his executive orders are similar to Roosevelt's, in that they went beyond executive action. Executive action is in fulfillment of existing law. So you're issuing an order to do something in some way to fulfill existing law. What Biden is doing, by contrast, for example, when he eliminated the Keystone XL pipeline and he changed the border policy of the United States, making it open borders, those were legislative actions. They changed the existing law. In fact, they violate the existing law. And he's done it in a way that assures that it will be implemented immediately. That is dictatorial. That is an assumption of extraordinary power. That's assumption of all the power of the government in one person. And that is totally unconstitutional.
I agree. Would you do away with all executive orders, or at least the ability to do that?
Well, I don't mind executive orders that fulfill legislation. In other words, if it's passed by Congress, signed into law by the president can use an executive order to ensure that it is implemented. And that is the historic way all the way back to George Washington.
Yeah, but that's like a moot point because, you know, once Congress approves it and the president signs it, it should become law anyway, right?
Right. But what is happening now is that the president is using power to create law. And that's of course, what the administrative agencies have done all the way back to 1887. They have always created law without the consent of the government.
You know, right. They're bypassing.
They're completely bypassing the constitutional doctrines and the Constitution itself. The vesting clauses in the Constitution have meaning. The power to make law is exclusively vested in the legislature. The power to evaluate the law and adjudicate the law is exclusively placed in the Article III courts. But the administrative state assumes all of that control. They're all powerful. In one agency, they have combined all those powers. And furthermore, they completely disregard the constitutional limits on power that apply to the judiciary when they function in administrative courts. They have recreated in this country the very courts the Founding Fathers rejected, the courts of High Commission, for example, and of Star Chamber. They use general warrants, which are forbidden by the Constitution. They deny, even though they take away your property and liberty, they have the power to do that, they do not afford you a jury trial. They don't allow you the presumption of innocence. There's no requirement that the government establish, for example, that an expert witness it's going to use is actually an expert. And in case after case, I have argued against these things in the administrative context, and fortunately have won several times. But it's all whenever I win in the administrative law context, in the administrative law judges, before the administrative law judges, the agency always reverses. Why does it do that? Why does the agency reverse? They're all political appointees. They never find themselves in error. They're the ones who initiate the prosecution. They're also the ultimate judge. So they're the prosecutor and the judge. That is inherently
dangerous.
Giving you justice.
Yeah, that's dangerous. What would you say, Jonathan, in your research might be the most unjustified, horrendous abuse of this power that you've seen?
The most horrendous abuse of this power, I think, is through the agencies, and it is the complete destruction of private enterprise, with the elimination of everyone's jobs, the gross publication before decision of charges as if they were by the government, as if they were proven, and the gross abuse of power by government prosecutors to ensure that the party they're accusing and charging will be basically incapable of defending itself because they destroy the markets that company works in. For example, over and over again, I've seen the government abuse the subpoena power, and this is how they do it. They've just charged a party, nothing more than a charge. But what they do is they subpoena every business that has had any interaction with that company, as well as others that may even be competitors. And by just sending subpoenas that are intrusive, they alert these people that do business with the company that, boy, oh, boy, that company's the target of a government investigation. I had better discontinue my relationship with them because I might be a target. And the lawyers for these companies tell them that. You know, you get a subpoena from a federal agency that's all-powerful that can put you out of business or can send investigators in without any notice to you and go through all your records and go through your business. You're not going to want to ruffle the feathers of the government. So what do? They cut off the business. They stop working with the company.
Yep.
They therefore make it impossible for the company to manufacture. They make it impossible for the company.
They squeeze you.
They squeeze them so much that they and then they have prolonged prosecutions that cost millions of dollars before a party can even get to court. They have to exhaust their administrative remedies. So they know they have this power, they know they can abuse it, and they routinely abuse it to destroy companies, and all their employees suffer, the whole marketplace suffers. And as I point out in the authoritarians with specific examples, time and again, this has ruined companies that have really, they may be in violation of a technical rule, but they've done nothing that has caused harm to anyone.
Jonathan, let me ask you this. Whether you're pro or against vaccines, does government and should government have the right to mandate you will get a shot?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It is fundamental to our freedom, basic liberties under the Constitution, that we have the right to refuse receipt of medication. We have a right to personal autonomy, to control our own bodies. Now, having said that, it is the tragedy that, I explain this in detail in The Authoritarians, that the Supreme Court took a turn towards progressivism in the progressive era before the New Deal era, and actually created a precedent in Jacobson versus Massachusetts that robs us of our rights to argue against vaccination. And that is a peculiar decision. It doesn't fit with the 14th Amendment and 5th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. It doesn't comport with the right to liberty under those two constitutional provisions. And in all other instances, the government applies strict scrutiny when your liberty rights are at stake. In the case of the quote-unquote public interest or public good from vaccination, they wiped it away and said, no, essentially a rational basis will do. And that just means that the government can articulate a justification, and that justification will be upheld by the courts. Now, I think it's going to be a test. First of all, I think that the Biden administration has received so much negative publicity and so much flack from liberals and conservatives on this point that they're going to use a untoward but typical means of pressuring businesses to adopt vaccine mandate passport type thing rather than have a federal mandate. Now, that may change. If they think they can get away with it, they will. We have a fight in store coming up on this, and it may end up with a change in that old decision, Jacobson. It really should, because it sticks out like a sore thumb. But there are many decisions like that which have robbed us of our rights.
Well, keep up the good work, Jonathan. We're going to come back and take an hour of phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.